The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Chapter 1.
Food.
And words. And words.
And food.
The world is nothing without life, and all that lives takes nourishment. Animals feed, man eats. Only the man of intellect knows how to eat.
On the table is a starched white tablecloth.
Do we need to get some plates?
On the tablecloth, 20 books.
Books that contain recipes and writing about food.
Samuel Pepys, 1660, January the 26th. Home from my office to my lord's lodgings, where my wife had got ready a very fine dinner, viz. A dish of marrow bones, a leg of mutton, a loin of veal, a dish of fowl, 3 pullets, 2 dozen of larks, all in a dish. A great tart, a neat's tongue, a dish of anchovies, a dish of prawns, and cheese.
Around these books are 3 plates of food.
Oh, that smells nice. Oh, so nice.
Dishes also from the last 400 years.
Oh, that looks yummy. That's chocolate.
It's not actually.
It's not ginger.
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 Sort of.
Yeah, it's very like parkin. It's gingerbread.
But it's one of her signature things.
It is, isn't it? She calls it Acton gingerbread.
So flat.
With these plates are 3 women with a passion for food and a passion for words.
This has to be my favourite piece. In the months of April, the moon being new, sow marjoram, flower gentle, thyme, violets. In the full of the moon, apples of love and marvellous apples. And in the wane, artichokes, holy thistle, cabbage coal, citrons, hartshorn, samphire, gillyflowers, muggets and parsnips.
That was Penn Vogler, who has masterminded an amazing series of great food books for Penguin. And they're all sitting here in front of us. Penn, just tell us a little bit about that particular passage, what it is.
Well, that was written by Gervase Markham, published in 1615. And our book's called The Well-Kept Kitchen, which is a selection from his bigger book called The Complete Housewife. The idea really of the whole series is that it looks at food writing and recipes from about the last 400 years. So Gervase Markham's the earliest, and it comes up to Alice Waters and Claudia Roden, who are both still writing and cooking today. And it goes a little bit around the world as well. We look at the Raj, and we look at the war in the Crimea, we look at North America.
Now, also with us is Catherine Hughes, who, among her other many accomplishments, is the biographer of Mrs. Beaton. And Mrs. Beaton features in one of these books, doesn't she? Here we are. Look, this is more blousy than you usually see Mrs. Beaton illustrations.
Yes, well, it's blousy and it's much thinner, because the real Mrs. Beaton is kind of really, really big and swollen. What Penn's done here is extract the nuggets, the essence. And yeah, the illustration is not what you're used to, because normally we used to see all those jelly moulds. Every time we see Mrs. Beaton, she comes attached metaphorically with some jelly moulds. And I think this is very, very elegant.
It's got big sort of roses and peonies and things.
All the jackets actually are taken from contemporary ceramics.
Do they have recipes that you can actually use today?
A lot of them have got recipes that you can use. Some of them are just food writing. Some of them, like Charles Lamb and Samuel Pepys, they're just writing about food in their own particular way. But a lot of them, the joy of them is that they let you rediscover food from 300 or 200 years ago that we've forgotten. And sometimes you discover, you know, I find in recreating the food that we've forgotten it with good reason. It really doesn't work and it's disgusting. But often I discover recipes that are just wonderful.
And you've actually brought some of them
I
here,
have,
haven't
yes.
you? And the smell has been driving me absolutely mad. I can smell cinnamon and ginger. Is that
You right? can probably smell ginger. I don't think there's cinnamon in anything.
Ginger,
but
maybe.
Yeah, there's definitely ginger in there. Well, the first one that I've cooked is from Gervase Markham, who I was reading there. He was telling housewives how to sow herbs, and he also tells them how to cut herbs and things, and also how to cook, obviously. So what I've made is marchpane, which is simply marzipan, but cooked. And it's a far better way of eating marzipan, because it's delicious. And I don't know if you want to have a little sample
Looks gorgeous.
And taste it. But there's a very strong taste that reminds us of Turkish delight, and that's actually rose water.
Mm. Oh, yes. Mm. I wouldn't have thought of this as anything like marzipan,
yeah, actually. No. Actually, yes. I'm so glad because I hate modern marzipan.
Oh, do you?
So when you said what you cooked, I was thinking, oh my God, this is going to be disgusting. This is really, really gorgeous. It's very delicate, isn't it? It's like that kind of rose coming through.
Yes. Yeah. And the rose water is interesting because all those sort of spices and things that we get in Tudor food would have probably come originally from the Crusaders and probably Damask roses came over at the same time, rose water. So that Middle Eastern thing, that Turkish delight thing, you get in a lot in Tudor cookery.
That's completely unexpected, isn't it?
Yeah, and so rose water was used a lot until, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, but it seems to have gone out of fashion a bit.
But what's the next one, and where are we?
If we go a little, about 100 years later, the next one is this caraway cake, which is a recipe from Hannah Glass. And Hannah Glass was a wonderful, feisty lady who was poo-pooing this idea that it could only be men who were chefs.
And or French.
And
she
French.
Hated the French.
She hated French men. She said,
just a wrong thing about them.
And she said, if gentlemen will have French tricks, they must pay for French cooks. And she said that she basically wrote her cookery book to instruct the lower sort, so really for proper servants and proper cooks.
Now, I remember having, we called it seed cake, very like this, in the 1970s. Yeah. Right? We always had a cake for tea, and once a week it would be this.
Yeah. Seed cake.
So fashions do come round again, don't they?
I think so. I mean, I actually think that caraway is, I think that we should kind of, bring caraway back, because you used to have lovely caraway scones in Ireland, and the seed cake, and now it has this reputation of being a bit fusty. But I think it works quite well.
It's quite flat, this cake.
It is quite flat. In fact, most of these cakes are quite flat because we didn't really have raising agents until, do you think, Victorian times? So eggs would have had to have done all the work of raising a cake.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you realise that actually that cakes until the mid-19th century didn't look very spectacular. We're so used to the idea of, yum, cake, gorgeous visual image. And actually, although all these taste gorgeous, they're not lookers, are they, as material objects?
Well, possibly it's the way I've done them. March Payne, I mean, in a big Tudor feast, would have been gilded with gilt. And I saw somebody at Hampton Court who'd spent 3 days making a kind of March Payne shield. It was quite incredible. Great use of labour.
So what are we moving on to next?
Next, if we jump forward again about 100 years, this ginger cake, which is Acton gingerbread.
That's really famous, isn't it? That was one of her signature dishes.
I think it was a signature dish. And the thing I love about cooking from Eliza Acton is that she obviously cooked everything herself. Yeah. And her recipe instructions are really clear, and she says things like, melt the butter but don't make it so hot that otherwise the cake becomes heavy, and you think, you have made this, I trust you, and you can do it first time and it always works.
I think that's why she's such a favourite of everybody, from Elizabeth David to Delia Smith. You know, if you ask them who their favourite historical cook is, it's never Beaton or any of these people, it's always Eliza Acton. You can tell why it's gorgeous, this.
I love this because it's also got the taste of cloves in us as well. And I think it works really well, because I always think, cloves, it's a bit, a bit kind of dentist-y. But it's, for me, it's quite an interesting throwback to early gingerbread, because the first gingerbread made in medieval times was quite revolting. Well, I don't know, the way I've made it has been quite revolting. It's kind of honey and butter and breadcrumbs. But they would have decorated it with cloves. Again, they would have gilded
studded it.
They would have studded it with cloves. And I wonder whether that sort of putting those ginger and cloves together has actually come from medieval times.
Okay, so now we've got one more, has got an icing. So it's more decorative in a way than...
This is from Agnes Jekyll, who was a Times writer, food writer, and all her books were published together in about 1922. This is a chocolate cake she calls super chocolate cake that she recommends for an afternoon tea. And yes, it's got an icing on. And this is the only cake that's got that's actually got a raising agent, even though actually mine looks a
bit flat.
It's quite flat too. And I don't know if you want to taste it and tell me what you think the icing is.
I would never have guessed it was chocolate, by the way.
No, it's funny,
it looks like
ginger
again, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I think...
Oh! What on earth is that?
What on earth is that? It's a slightly odd taste in there.
It's lovely. You're pulling a face, Claire. I think it's lovely.
it's maraschino, which, you know, that cherry...
You can slightly see a slight cherryish blush on it, can't you?
Yeah, with that cherry liqueur that you get, those sort of cocktail cherries. And again, for me, there's something slightly kind of 1970s about her food, that kind of putting cherries and chocolate together like we all loved with Black Forest Gâteau.
I can be really honest. I was very, very excited about this because you did tell me you were bringing in a chocolate cake and it's not terribly chocolatey.
It's not that chocolatey, is it? No, I think... she doesn't use cocoa. She hasn't used cocoa powder, and it also has this other very strange taste because for a raising agent she uses sal volatile, you know, smelling salts, which was
I was reacting to.
Slightly medicinal. Woof.
You said she called this a super chocolate cake. I'm going to be really, really mean and say
it's not super. No.
This is the disappointment of
this. Is the disappointing?
Yes.
Everything else is gorgeous.
But she's she's interesting, is it? Because she was so kind of posh.
She was Lady Jekyll, wasn't she?
I think she was. I think she was Gertrude Jekyll's sister-in-law. Yes, she had these very, very posh dinner parties. And for her, food is all about the right food for the right occasion.
And that's one of the wonderful things that comes out of all these books is you get it's like looking through a window into somebody's life 100 years or 200 years ago, isn't it?
Yes, definitely, into somebody's life, and you're getting the sort of insight into the kitchens of the time. I mean, the Jervis Markham, it's a bit like looking into the kitchen of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall. But you also get a window into some sort of historical events as well. You know, you get a window into the Crimea, with a chef called Alexis Sawyer, who went off and kind of cooked with Florence Nightingale, so that her troops had nutritious food.
So, Catherine, as a food historian, what are food books? How have they changed over the centuries? Do they occupy the same place in the culture?
They kind of do. That's what's really interesting, because all the books that Penn has got in the series are so different. You read them all, they sound completely different, and yet there are these underlying themes and anxieties, and they're usually written for the middle classes. Actually, they're usually written for people who are slightly anxious about whether the way they're living now is quite the right way to be living. And there's always a sense in which they could perhaps slightly be doing it better, whether that means being a bit posher, like Lady Jekyll, or a bit more nutritionally savvy, or whatever it is. So there's always this kind of anxiety, and there's also, I have to say, what we have even now, the sort of Nigella effect. There's always an aspirational thing going on, so that these are books that kind of, we call them today, sort of best practices. They're not necessarily the way people actually cooked. It was the way that people hoped they might cook one day when they got their lives together.
Yeah, and I actually was looking at the bestseller lists for this week, and five of the top hardback non-fiction titles exactly bear out your point. They're food books, but it's people like Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall and Jamie Oliver, all, who are telling us how we should be living our lives, partly, aren't they, as well as producing food books.
Yeah, I mean, that's these food books go straight into whatever your contemporary anxiety. So at the moment it's all about health and consumption and environment, but if you take any of these books, you only have to read a couple of pages and you're immediately taken back into the mindset, whether it's the 17th century or the 19th century.
Now I want to ask you about this particular book, Penn, which is my personal favourite, and it's by one Colonel Wyvern, who I'd never heard of before, and it's, you've called it Notes from Madras, but that's your title
that's
for it,
our
isn't
title.
It? Just tell me about him. It's absolutely wonderful.
He was wonderful. He was a colonel in the Raj, in the colonial India, and he obviously looked around at the Memsahibs struggling to try and make these kind of dramatic French-style dinner parties in the heat and dust of sort of Indian kitchens with whatever resources they had available, or with their trying to communicate with their Indian cooks. And he did two things. He said, this is an easy way to do it. You've got to have your French dinner parties. But the thing that I love him for, and possibly you as well, is that he said, cook curry. Don't forget to cook curry. It's really good. It's tasty. It's nice. And, go to the market in Bangalore and bring all these lovely fresh vegetables and spices back.
And you get this vision of all these poor Raj families who are enthralled to Messrs., as he puts it, Messrs. Cross and Blackwell.
That's right.
When actually there's all that lovely fresh stuff out in the markets that they were intimidated by.
And interestingly, he said, clearly, our uncles and our grandfathers and our great-grandfathers used to, eat mulligatawny soup. And it had obviously fallen out of fashion. So early Raj, they cook curry. And obviously, like Catherine is saying about that aspirational thing, they were obviously trying to aspire away from their grandfathers and become much more kind of high society English. And he's bringing them back, he's trying to bring them back down to earth. Mm-hmm. It is a very odd cake. Yes.
I was kind of, in my childish way, hoping for death by chocolate.
Yes. Yeah. So definitely my least favourite of all of them, I have to say. But I think I love this.
This is great. I just think this is
you like that one? Which one do you like? Do you like it? It's okay, isn't it? Yeah, it's not. It's not. I like this one, the seed cake. That's the taste of my childhood. And it was in Nigeria.
Chapter 2.
September the 11th, 10 years on.
When you wake up in the morning, the world is as you find it. What's happened in the night is history or dream. That's the only way I can account for the weird feeling that I sort of missed 9/11.
There can be few people in the world who are unaware that this weekend is the 10th anniversary of the attack on New York's Twin Towers. It was an event whose repercussions are still echoing around the world. As Carmilla Shamsie wrote in one of 6 specially commissioned short stories which have been running on the Guardian website this week, America had 9/11, England had 7/7, India had 26/11, Pakistan has 24/7. Richard Lee, who commissioned the series, is here with us now.
Well, the Guardian's been covering, obviously, since in the 10 years since the attacks, the Guardian's produced an immense array of multimedia, news, features, reportage, everything. We thought that the occasion of the anniversary, 10 years later, was something that demanded a creative response. So on the books desk, for us, that was short fiction. So we've asked 6 writers from all around the world to reflect on what's happened and what hasn't, what's changed and what's not in those 10 years, which Pankaj Mishra has called our low, dishonest decade, in an attempt to have a look at how these events have affected our imagination. You heard a fragment just now from Jeff Dyer's Temple of Tears, which opens on the morning of the attacks from the other side of the continent, but on the actual morning of the attacks. But Laila Lalami, whose story Echo, is said in a much broader way. It moves from a professor who's looking for a new job in contemporary Bay City back to hints of protest and disturbance in the 1970s.
Mona took a sip of her coffee and sat down in the dining room to leaf through the album. Inside it were photographs from that mysterious era in her parents' lives, on a long wharf by a lake, a dinner with a group of friends, at a rally against the regime, on a beach in Agadir, in a horse-drawn carriage in Marrakesh. Mona and her sister were nowhere in these pictures, their existence not yet planned, or perhaps not even imagined.
But it's not just us who've been thinking about how to mark the anniversary in a literary way. The editor of Granter, John Freeman, joins us down the line now from New York. Was there ever any doubt in your mind about whether to do a 9/11 anniversary issue?
Very briefly, because I knew a lot of magazines here in the US would be doing something very similar. But once I started to think about it and realized that the only kind of 10 years later issue we would do would be something focused on the global repercussions of the attacks of 9/11 and the ripples of it, I realized that we probably wouldn't be in a very crowded space, because right now all those same issues of other magazines are breaking, and largely here in the U.S. they're focused on New York, on the attacks, and on the lives of the first responders and firemen and families who were affected by it.
So you don't have a story set in New York or in Washington, do you?
We don't. We have one poem by an Arab-American poet named Lawrence Joseph, who's fantastic and worth reading if you've never heard of him. He's got a poem set down by Ground Zero. He was there on the day of the attacks, and it's quite a piece.
Now, Richard, we didn't have a New York story either. I'm really interested in this absence, because in a way, of course, that's the centre of the whole thing, isn't it?
Well, we didn't rule it out as such, but we were determined to avoid an idea, an issue that one of the characters in Carmilla Shamsie's story calls the idea that there's something singular or something exceptional about suffering when it happens to Americans. Obviously, you know, almost 3,000 people died in New York and Washington, and the world kind of shifted on its axis. But the reverberations, as John was saying, have been felt all around the world. So we want to try and capture that, some of the kind of ripples. So we've got Helen Habila, who was born in Nigeria and lives in Virginia now. We've got Laila Lalami, who was born in Morocco and lives in California. You just heard a fragment from her story now. Carmela herself, who was born in Karachi alongside Jeff Dyer and Will Self, who are kind of more familiar names from the UK. But we also wanted to have something which reflected what the war looked like from the opposite end of America, from New York City, the kind of something away from the city and the countryside. Mm-hmm. So we're also, I'm delighted to have a great story set on a farm in Oregon from Rob Magnuson Smith.
John, you're doing fiction and non-fiction and poetry, as you've mentioned. How did you balance the different genres?
I tend to think of it all as literature, and we're always looking for something that's new. And I think one of the problems about writing about 9/11 is that it's become almost ritualistic, in that you have the attacks and the aftermath of the attacks. And what we were looking for in particular was, what have the attacks made possible? What's been done in the name of the attacks? And so we have a whole piece by Declan Walsh, who writes also.
Oh, he's our own Declan Walsh, yes.
We'll fight you for him, but he's a terrific writer, because he manages to take the drone strikes and what is now the largest targeted assassination program in U.S. history in Pakistan, and put it in context of previous engagements there in the Northwest Frontier mm-hmm. Province. And those kinds of stories need a lot of space to be told properly. And I think what's happened in the world of the media and in storytelling is that the context of history is often lost in that kind of effort to catch up, and pieces like Declan's were important for us.
But you've also got some really very interesting, intriguing contributors. I know Richard's particularly fascinated by Phil Clay. Tell us about him.
He's a Marine. He did a 15-month tour in Iraq and came back and went to Hunter College, where Peter Carey and Colin McCann teach, and started writing short stories about Marines both in and outside of Iraq. And what I like about him is he's writing about the difficulty of leaving, of coming down from combat highs and readapting to life here. And he's only about 25 or 26 and has a huge future ahead of him. And on the flip side, we have another Marine named Elliot Woods, who went on a 12 to 13,000 mile road trip around the U.S. talking to other Marines who've come home from the war and how they're dealing with readjusting, and also some of them who are wanting to go back because they don't fit in America anymore in a non-combat zone. Mm-hmm. What I hope that both could do is show the ways that a militarized society it makes some people useful in one context, but when they come out of that context, they really struggle.
Mm-hmm. You've also got, now looking down the list, Nicole Krauss, who is actually a very New York-based writer, isn't she?
She is, but this is a piece set in Paris, and it's about, in many ways, trying to decide whether or not to tell her son about the Holocaust, and how much of the legacy of world traumas do you pass on to your children. I think about this a lot here in New York, with all the people who left, and there's a whole almost city of people who have moved here since 9/11. And those of us who lived here on that day feel very different from those who watched it on television, I think.
You were there on that day, were you?
Yeah, I used to live a mile from the Trade Towers, so I watched it from my bedroom window and from the roof of my apartment building.
But however, Granta is now a UK-based magazine, and you're in New York introducing it back into the city where this all happened. What sort of reception have you had?
We've had two events so far, one with Phil Clay and another writer named Samantha Smith, whose father was a policeman, and we ran a piece by her on our website. And last night we had a panel at Columbia University about Islamophobia, which is one of the unfortunate responses that America had to the attacks of 9/11, which is to target Muslims. It's been very good, and we've had actually another 10 or so events around the country. We're having 50 in the next 2 to 3 weeks in Islamabad and Delhi. And a lot of these events, the contributors will be there, or it's writers from Granta who are having a discussion about the issue and about just how the world has changed since 9/11 and how storytelling in some ways has changed.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. Richard, have we had that sort of activity going on around our stories? What sort of response have we had?
Yeah, well, the reaction's been building. I think some of the first comments that we had on a little piece we had introducing the series were weren't convinced by the mismatch at the heart of Jeff Dyer's story between the personal and the global
there's
arena.
There's a lot about a sofa, wasn't there?
Yeah, exactly. But that was kind of the point of it to me. Through the week, people, I mean, there've been Paul Bowes, 01, hailed Habila's deft handling of the echoes between spy fiction and reality in his story, The Second Death of Martin Lango. But he also goes on to question whether it's a 9/11 story. I mean, maybe we've kind of slightly missold these, as I think our intention was always to draw the net a little wider, as yours was, John. He says that it's calling it 9/11 story is a bit of a stretch. But we were always after these stories that opened the door, that chased the implications a little wider. We've also had a nice little exchange running on Twitter where somebody calling themselves Fells77 says doesn't know what to make of Martin Lango, the story of Martin Lango, while Ekpedeku Moebila, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, replies that it's just kind of amazingly spellbinding. Again, that's kind of the response that I think I was after. Is there something that when you read it, you think that's kind of moving in a kind of mysterious way, but you're not quite sure where it's taking you? I think was that a kind of response that you were looking for, John?
I really like the stories that you've been running because they don't focus entirely only on that day and New York City or Washington. And I think if that's the definition of 9/11 literature, I think there is no such thing as Pearl Harbor literature. There's no D-Day literature. So I think the point of literature is to complicate and ask questions. And if we're going to do that, then I think it has to be a much broader remit than simply reimagining what was in fact the most recorded and captured visually day in human history.
I really like your point about it having changed the way we tell stories, and I wondered if partly the relationship between photographs and text had changed. Now, you actually have, of course, in Granta, as always, you have some very striking photographs as well as text.
We have a photo essay by an American photographer named Nadia Shira Cohen, who spent some time in refugee camps on the border of Libya and Tunisia, and there was African and Bangladeshi migrant workers who had been spending time in the oil fields and other industries in Libya who were booted out as a result of the revolution there. And this is just one example of one of the side effects of something that a lot of us from afar watch with trepidation but with hope, and then you realize that many other people, as much as they might support it themselves, are probably, their lives are, if not ruined, then they're irrevocably changed. Mm. And I think Nadia's photographs are really quite striking because they remind me to some degree of Jacob Lawrence's Great Migration series about African Americans migrating from the South North.
And yeah, so there, for example, movement. I'm looking at a lovely picture here now of a young man showering himself from an aluminium food bowl, basically, with just a bucket standing by him. It's very oblique, if you're as a response to 9/11.
9/11, in many ways, is an encounter, not just between populations and worldviews, but East and West. And we feel those encounters, that encounter, most intimately, either in literature or in our daily lives, in ways that where something intimate has to be done publicly, or we have an encounter like the character in Leila Alami's story, meeting a soldier who spent time in Iraq as her delivery man while accepting a package on her front doorstep. And fiction is so good at turning those encounters into a keyhole through which to view much larger things.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Now, these are both two big set pieces that you've both put into the calendar year. Are there other events that would make you do this again?
We thought briefly about turning this issue into a kind of Jasmine Revolution kind of issue, because so many of the pieces that we were initially looking for were going to be coming from the Middle East. But the dust hasn't nearly settled there, and we're, at least as a magazine, I feel like Grant is much better at looking from a slight distance or from a refractory angle.
So the Arab Spring will be coming in 10 years' time?
Yeah, or 13 or 12, who knows?
Anyway, thank you very much, both of you, for coming to talk to us. So that's it for this week. If you missed any of our Edinburgh Books Festival programmes, they're still on our site at guardian.co.uk/books. Just click on the quick link for podcasts at the top or bottom of the page. And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast by clicking on the link of the podcast player or going to iTunes. But before we go, what else do we have to look out for on our website or papers over the coming week, Richard?
Well, on the site, we're bringing that series of short stories about 9/11 to a close with a story from Will Self tomorrow, which examines how technology has transformed our relationship to reality. And we've also got the discussion on our brand new reading group hotting up, where our users have chosen Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451.
Can you just explain the reading group to us? Because it's slightly different to John Mullen's book group, isn't it? Which some people might...
Absolutely. This is an online only activity where the idea is that the readers, our users, get together and decide which book they're going to read every month and then talk about it. So this month we've had Flyboy Rascal saying that he thoroughly enjoyed Fahrenheit 451 as a 13-year-old punk rocker. It left him with a love of protectiveness towards books, a symbol of free thought and expression, he says. Whereas Mark Hadley found himself losing interest with scenes of overblown rhetoric. This debate is going to continue for the rest of the month, so there's plenty of time to join in.
And there is, if you go to our Reading Room page, which is new, you can find all sorts of background, including Ray Bradbury, bits of writing from him, stuff about him, all sorts, everything you ever wanted to know, and possibly a little bit more if you're not a fan like Mark Hadley. Otherwise, in tomorrow's review, Blake Morrison analyses the enduring appeal of the Bronte sisters, and Christopher Hitchens looks back on 10 years of writing after the attacks of New York and Washington. The 9/11 theme continues in The Observer on Sunday with Ian Birrell on the literary legacy of the last decade, plus Andrew Rawnsley on Alistair Darling's memoir of life at number 11. So from Richard Lee, our producer Tim Mabey, and me, Claire Armistead, goodbye. We're going off to finish the cake.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.